Curtis Warren couldn't see a thing. The moment his prison cell door opened, guards blindfolded and shackled him. He was led around a serpentine path intended to disorient him. Then, after a short helicopter ride to the nearby army base, Curtis was shoved into the back of a truck. The feeling of cold metal was unmistakable. A heavily armored vehicle.
When the van finally stopped, someone ripped off his blindfold. For the first time in 6 months, Curtis Warren caught his first glimpse of the outside. He recognized the bland but imposing Palace of Justice in The Hague, Netherlands. And a dozen special forces with machine guns were standing in front of him.
As he marched up the courthouse steps, Curtis noticed men stationed at windows in nearby buildings with rifles trained at him. Along the street beneath them were journalists and photographers, all trying to catch a glimpse of Curtis.
As he disappeared inside the courthouse, a journalist for the British Sunday Times furiously jotted down notes. Weeks earlier, the paper had featured Curtis in its annual Rich List, a celebration of Britain's wealthiest and most successful people. And now, they had to feature him again. This time, as Europe's most wanted man.
Welcome to Kingpins, a podcast original. I'm Alastair Murden.
And I'm Kate Leonard. Every Friday, we journey inside the ranks of organized crime rings, from street gangs to mafiosos, to understand how a kingpin or queenpin rises to the top of the underworld.
And why they fall. As we follow the lives of infamous crime bosses, we'll explore how money and power change them, and how it changed the community around them.
You can find episodes of Kingpins and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Kingpins for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Kingpins in the search bar.
This is our second episode on Curtis Warren, the man who took British drug trafficking to new heights in the early 1990s. Last week, we followed Curtis's turn to petty crime while growing up in an impoverished pocket of Liverpool. That eventually blossomed into a burgeoning career as a drug dealer, allegedly culminating in huge cocaine deals with the Colombian Cali cartel.
This week, we'll explore how Curtis built upon his drug empire, both in the UK and abroad, and how his ambitions and overconfidence ultimately gave the authorities the upper hand in their quest to take him down.
We'll dive into the fall of the cocky watchman right after this.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit, or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at IKEA-USA.com/circular. Visit IKEA-USA.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement.
Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
In the spring of 1993, Curtis Warren was untouchable. That's certainly what he believed after a bungled attempt to convict him of drug trafficking. The British authorities threw a damning heap of evidence at him, but Curtis overcame the charges and walked away scot-free.
This incredible triumph was decades in the making. After a troubled childhood filled with personal struggles and brushes with the law, it was finally time for 30-year-old Curtis Warren to take a victory lap. And that's literally what he did.
Immediately following his acquittal, Curtis reportedly jumped into his open-topped Lexus and cruised through the streets of his old Toxteth neighborhood in Liverpool, England. Droves of friends and strangers streamed out to greet the now legendary local hero.
For Curtis, his unexpected release meant it was time to get back in business. He was keenly aware, though, that the cops were ready to pull at every last thread to unravel his operation. They wouldn't be stopped a second time. Curtis was going to have to adapt.
Though his Cali cartel connection had been severed because of the arrest, that didn't mean Curtis had no relationships with other big-time drug suppliers. The first successful Cali shipment had provided him with a lot of clout, and plenty of international suppliers were still eager to do business with him.
More importantly, Curtis still maintained a wide-reaching network of Liverpool street dealers. He had the manpower to push drugs into the grubby hands of users all over the lucrative English market.
Curtis had picked up a couple tricks during his legal quagmire. The cops had shown him that just one loose-lipped person with too much information could bring his whole business down. Now that he was back on the streets, Curtis radically compartmentalized his operation. He made sure no one had too much knowledge or access. One investigator claimed that two strangers might be standing next to each other in a bar, and they could both be working for Warren, yet neither had a clue about the other one.
Ironically, Curtis's legal conquest came with another benefit: increased trust with the Liverpool Mafia. During his trial, he didn't rat on anyone, not even a passing mention of his financial benefactor, who the authors of the book Cocky aptly call the banker.
In fact, Liverpool's criminal elders believed that Curtis had overtaken the banker's place. He wasn't just a young buck anymore. Curtis was at the top of the food chain. Now it was time to pass down morsels to the people below him.
And he knew the exact places to serve it up.
By the mid-1990s, underground rave parties had spread through England like wildfire. With that came an endless appetite for drugs, especially ecstasy, and Curtis was happy to supply.
When he was still a small-timer, Curtis had used his group of bouncers-turned-drug dealers to push his product. Now, according to some sources, he legitimized this business model by setting up private security companies. Those dealers were now on the books as club security contractors, and they would control the doors and the flow of drugs to Britain's best parties.
Money was flowing into everyone's pockets. Curtis himself was taking in millions. Some said it numbered in the tens of millions.
His quick climb was made possible by his sober judgment. The drugs never touched him, and he never touched them. By literally keeping his nose clean, Curtis ensured that his cloak of invincibility never got dirty.
But by August 1993, the same men who had pursued Curtis just months before were back on his trail. UK law enforcement created the largest joint task force in history in order to bring him down. Operation Crayfish.
Working out of a secret military installation they coined Fraggle Rock after the popular kids' TV show, they began their huge undertaking. Over the next few years, this team bugged phones, trailed dealers, and intercepted shipments, hoping to catch Curtis in the act.
But Curtis played it smart, avoiding close calls and walking away from deals when they seemed too risky. With every missed opportunity, the men of Operation Crayfish realized it would take more than a few cops rattling Curtis's cage to get him to change his routine.
It took longer than anyone expected, but Britain's new Target 1 was eventually thrown off balance. Surprisingly, not by the police, but by his fellow criminals.
For years, the various criminal factions of Liverpool had lived in relative harmony. The black and mixed-race crews from Curtis's Granby area often socialized with the white gangs from neighboring Dingle. A gentleman's agreement was made that each organization would respect each other's territories.
But that delicate truce collapsed the winter of 1994. It all began when one up-and-coming gangster and his crew were tossed out of a club for causing trouble on Christmas Day. He returned with a gun and opened fire, hitting a couple bouncers connected to a rival gang. This minor incident escalated to unprecedented violence.
By the summer of 1995, a full-on gang war had erupted in the streets of Liverpool. It became known as the Door Wars, since so much of the violence occurred in and outside of clubs.
Because Curtis's business depended on those venues, the bloodshed was disastrous for him. No one wanted to be knocking back tabs of ecstasy in the club when bullets could start flying at any moment.
Things came to a head on May 1st, 1995, when a businessman named David Ungi was murdered in a drive-by shooting. Ungi was rumored to have ties to the city's white gangs, and his high-profile execution sent shockwaves throughout the underworld.
Ungi's death forced Curtis to choose sides. As a biracial man, he had the ability to work closely with both the predominantly white Liverpool mafia as well as the influential Black Caucus, so nicknamed by the police. But with the city at each other's throats, being able to play both sides was becoming impossible.
At first, Curtis tried to play mediator. The police spotted him with members of the rival factions, passionately pleading that no one had anything to gain from petty squabbles.
But as bodies continued to pile up through 1995, it was clear the war wouldn't end peacefully. And Curtis began to worry that it was only a matter of time until the violence reached him.
This fact was not lost on Operation Crayfish. The cops redoubled their efforts, trailing Curtis a little more openly in an attempt to spook him. It worked. With his industry falling into chaos and his associates killing each other in the streets, the pressure for law enforcement pushed Curtis into complete paranoia.
He wasn't sure he could trust the cops to play by the rules. He likely believed they could shoot him down on the street and make it look like a gang hit. He had to make a change. A change that no one would expect.
So, in the final months of 1995, suddenly and without warning, the UK's most wanted drug trafficker disappeared. Coming up, Curtis Warren begins to bite off more than he can chew. Hi, it's Kate, and I have some very big and timely news. Very Presidential with Ashley Flowers is the newest Spotify original from Parcast, and it uncovers the most damning details surrounding history's most high-profile leaders. Every Tuesday through the 2020 election, host Ashley Flowers shines a light on the darker side of the American presidency. From torrid love affairs and contemptible corruption to blackmail schemes and even murder, she'll expose the personal and professional controversies you may never knew existed. And you'll hear some wildly true stories about presidents such as Richard Nixon, George Washington, Andrew Jackson, and more. Family drama, personal vices, dirty secrets. Very Presidential highlights the exploits you never learned in history class, but probably should have. Follow the new series Very Presidential with Ashley Flowers free on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, The gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
Now, back to the story.
As 1995 came to a close, 32-year-old Curtis Warren was feeling the pain of two completely different thorns in his side. The first was the gang war that had overtaken Liverpool. Curtis wanted nothing more than to see it end. It was ruining business.
The other problem was Operation Crayfish. The details of the UK Joint Task Force were unknown to Curtis, but he could feel law enforcement's presence with each passing day. More and more arrests and shipment seizures drove him to new levels of paranoia.
But Curtis had no intention of stopping. So if Liverpool was heating up, the only solution was to get out of the kitchen. Curtis Warren suddenly left town.
In early 1996, Operation Crayfish lost track of their target one. Worse yet, his drugs continued to pour into the UK from all directions.
Despite their best attempts to stem the tide, Curtis was coordinating an unprecedented flow of narcotics into the country. They just didn't know how he was doing it or from where.
Sossenheim, Holland, is a sleepy town, even by the quaint standards of Europe. Nestled in between the bustling port town Rotterdam and rowdy Amsterdam, it's an easy place to miss on the map. Which is exactly why Curtis Warren picked it.
At some point in late 1995, Curtis decided to rent out a 16-room villa named Bacara. Sparsely decorated and surrounded by farmland and fields of tulips, Scarface's Miami mansion, this was not. And that was the point.
Curtis felt completely safe behind the walls of Bacara. Virtually no one knew where he was. In rural Holland, he could have his cake and eat it too. By day, he could conduct his business in anonymity.
And by night, all he had to do was hop on the A4 motorway, and in 30 minutes, he was partying with high-class escorts in Amsterdam's finest clubs. Early on in his smuggling days, Curtis learned that Amsterdam had everything he needed to operate his business. The only difference being now he had the money and power to kick it up a notch. And that's precisely what he did.
Curtis remained piped into the UK drug scene, but now he could more easily and safely facilitate the flow of goods into the country. Ecstasy and designer drugs from the Netherlands, marijuana growing in Northern Africa, heroin from the Middle East, and it all traveled through his new home in Holland.
Building those relationships allowed him to spread his wings and export internationally. Before long, drugs consumed in Ibiza or on Bondi Beach in Sydney likely bore the stamp of Curtis's handiwork.
But there was one more drug that Curtis needed to be back in business with. Cocaine. This meant rebuilding his pipeline with his former friends in the Cali cartel. Curtis knew he would have to be more careful with who he partnered up with. The Colombians wouldn't take kindly to another rat like Brian Charrington.
Enter Manchester-born burly redhead Stephen Mee, alias Tony Farrell. Like Curtis, Mee cut his teeth in petty crime before graduating to drug trafficking. His claim to fame was transporting drugs from South America to the nearby Dutch Caribbean island of Curaçao. There, he handed them over to English couples with children who posed as tourists and smuggled the drugs into the UK.
Mee was a fugitive from British justice, having escaped from a prison van while on his way to serve 22 years. Needless to say, after meeting him in Amsterdam in the early months of 1996, Curtis knew he could trust Mee not to flip.
With me acting as an intermediary to the South American drug lords, Curtis reestablished his connection with ease. Unlike before, Cocky could now buy cocaine in bulk with his own money and control the shipments himself.
As far as Curtis knew, he was operating totally under the radar.
It's unclear how, but by May 14, 1996, Operation Crayfish had found their man. Target 1, Curtis Cocky Warren, was hiding out in a small Dutch town. And for all of his clever ideas, Curtis was in the dark about something very important, Dutch laws.
Despite their exceedingly progressive drug and sex trade laws, the Netherlands also allowed some aggressive law enforcement tactics. Unlike the UK, in the Netherlands, secret wiretaps were admissible in court.
A delegation from Operation Crayfish flew to the Netherlands to coordinate the investigation. The Dutch police were initially resistant to waste resources on what seemed to be a random drug dealer from Liverpool.
But when Crayfish laid out all their intel on Curtis, the Dutch authorities quickly changed their tune. Curtis's connections spanned the globe. He was the linchpin to numerous organizations across the continent. The Turkish Mafia, Sicilian Cosa Nostra, the Moroccan Tangiers Cartel. No question, UK's Target One now became Europe's most wanted.
On May 25th, the joint UK and Dutch operation was launched. They quickly realized surveillance was easier said than done. Even the most absent-minded crook could spot a police tail behind them on a half-empty rural Dutch street. If they couldn't track Curtis visually, they'd have to listen in on his conversations.
As soon as the ink was dry on the phone tap warrant, they got a team to intercept every mobile phone number they could find connected to Curtis and his associates.
But there was one last unexpected obstacle: deciphering what Curtis was saying over the phone. Curtis was intentionally cryptic, as he had been taught to be exceedingly careful over the phone.
But even more difficult was making sense of Curtis's oppressively thick Scouse accent and backslang. The utterly mystifying Liverpool vernacular was too much for the police. It got so bad that a handful of local officers were sent in from Liverpool to translate.
Unfortunately, translating Curtis's speech into normal, readable English was a time-consuming effort, time they didn't have.
Dutch law didn't allow for endless surveillance. Phone intercept targets had to be informed they were being listened to after 6 months, and they had the right to receive copies of all the transcripts. If they didn't take down Curtis soon, it would be all over.
Luckily, Curtis gave them plenty to work with. During that short time, they taped 14,000 calls. Piles and piles of transcripts they would later call the Dutch product, a tongue-in-cheek reference to Curtis's own commodities.
They picked apart all of Curtis's habits down to what time he brushed his teeth. They knew they'd need every detail if they wanted to convict him.
Some of the calls included Curtis yelling at associates who screwed up deals and bragging about beating up on low-level thugs. They noticed that he was lashing out against his friends. His arrogance was making enemies out of allies, and they hoped to exploit that.
As the months ticked away, investigators noticed that Curtis was letting down his guard, divulging more information than he would have back in Liverpool. He was completely unaware that every tidbit he let slip was another thread in the noose he was tying around his own neck.
The final knot was tied in the middle of October 1996, with just a month to spare before the police's six-month window drew to a close.
On October 16th, the merchant ship Columbia arrived in the Dutch port of Rotterdam after a three-week trip from South America. Any cop could guess it was a huge delivery of cocaine from the Cali cartel.
They believed they had uncovered Curtis's outrageous but ingenious plan. First, he'd send the drugs via train to Bulgaria, where he owned an actual winery. He came up with a method to cut down the cocaine and dissolve it in wine bottles, ship those back to the UK, and then separate the two substances. He planned to sell off the drugs and the wine, which he was ready to relabel as expensive counterfeits.
Unfortunately, someone, somewhere in Curtis's chain of criminality, had forgotten to pay for the voyage to Bulgaria. So, the cocaine remained in a container in Rotterdam. And the longer it sat there, the more likely someone would find it.
When word got to Curtis, he was livid. With the anger clouding his judgment, he personally sent a fax to the port to expedite the release of his shipment. Proof he was directly connected to the drugs.
The Dutch and English authorities observed everything. And with all the evidence they had gathered, now was the perfect moment to strike.
In the early morning hours of October 24, 1996, every law enforcement official that had been involved in Operation Crayfish was preparing to take down Curtis's whole operation. Raids in the Netherlands and Liverpool were coordinated to strike at the same time.
At 5 a.m., at least 10 officers smashed into Curtis's Bacara home from several entry points. They covered every room until finally bursting into the bedroom, where they found Curtis Warren sleeping in his bed, alone and unarmed.
He was jolted awake by men in black masks, assault rifles trained at his face. He didn't put up a fight. All of his bravado was sapped from him as they threw cuffs on him and led him to an armored car.
As he sat there in his pajamas, removed of all dignity, a rare sensation washed over Curtis. Fear.
Coming up, Curtis Warren faces the music. Now back to the story.
In October 1996, 33-year-old Curtis Warren's luck ran out. Following years of running his drug empire from secluded Sassenheim in the Netherlands, the authorities finally caught the kingpin in his castle.
When all was said and done, six of Curtis's properties were raided in the Netherlands, along with 20 in the UK. They found 1,500 kilos of cannabis, 60 kilos of heroin, 50 kilos of ecstasy, crates of hand grenades and hundreds of tear gas canisters, countless firearms, false passports, and stacks of cash in different currencies. The team that hit his Rotterdam shipment uncovered 400 kilos of cocaine.
All told, the contraband valued at well over $200 million today.
Curtis was kept in solitary confinement in a Dutch prison for weeks following his arrest. His only visitors were guards with meals, police with questions, and his lawyer with bad news.
He was horrified to learn about the countless hours of incriminating wiretaps. He foolishly believed he had been a step ahead of his pursuers, when in fact, they had been right on top of him this whole time.
The fallout was far-reaching. Shock and fear rippled through the underworld. From the Liverpool gangs to the cartels in Colombia, criminal organizations around the globe could be tied to Curtis Warren.
Since he committed his crimes on Dutch soil, Curtis was tried in the Netherlands. The first preliminary hearing took place in January 1997. He knew the charges, criminal conspiracy, drug smuggling, and possession of firearms, carried a maximum sentence of 16 years. That would keep Curtis behind bars until he was nearly 50 years old.
The curtains went up on April 9th. Curtis Warren was taken out of his cell and escorted to The Hague with maximum security fit for Hannibal Lecter. It was quite the display, with a local attorney admitting, "This level of security is unprecedented in this country. We never see things like this."
Curtis Warren made sure that he be seen as an anomaly. Despite his attorney's best efforts to convince him otherwise, He wore a gray sweatshirt, blue jogging pants, and white sneakers.
As always, he had a more devious reason for his relaxed appearance. A few weeks earlier, the Sunday Times had embarrassingly included him on their annual rich list of the UK's wealthiest individuals. He was listed as a real estate mogul with an estimated worth of 40 million British pounds. That was a problem for his case. If Curtis had millions in legitimate assets, then just how much illicit wealth did he have hidden away?
And thus began a long and intensive forensic accounting effort. Curtis would fight them every step of the way. On June 18, 1997, while the proceedings were ongoing, Curtis sent a fax to a British television network claiming any news about his wealth were exaggerated. He stated he only had one house in northern England, two small properties in Liverpool, and was renting his place in Holland. Did that sound like the holdings of one of the UK's wealthiest real estate speculators?
Of course, the investigation discovered that he likely owned hundreds of properties around the world. That included pubs and brothels in the UK, the winery in Bulgaria, a shopping arcade in Turkey, even supposed property as far as Africa. Not to mention hidden funds stashed away in banks in Switzerland and Dubai.
Curtis's swagger was back on full display in the later days of his trial. He routinely made elaborate, improvised statements and claimed the arrest had been illegal and corruption was at play. He was still cocky.
And yet, his bravado couldn't save him. On Thursday, June 19, 1997, just a few weeks after his 34th birthday, Curtis was found guilty on all counts. The Dutch court sentenced him to 12 years in prison without parole.
Justice had been served. Or at least that's what the British press plastered all over their headlines. But the men of Operation Crayfish felt otherwise. Yes, they finally got their man, but he was locked up in a Dutch prison with a sentence much shorter than he would have received in the UK.
As for Curtis, he certainly didn't feel like he caught a break. He was remanded to the most infamous maximum security prison in the Netherlands. Formerly a Nazi prisoner of war camp, it was anything but cushy. His fellow inmates included terrorists, war criminals, and murderers.
But Curtis would not be intimidated. He lost weight and bulked up, transforming his body into a fighting machine. And once again, Curtis's foresight would save him.
On September 15, 1999, Curtis was attacked by a fellow inmate by the name of Cemal Güçlü. Cemal was known throughout the prison as nothing less than psychotic, having already killed and maimed several fellow inmates, often for no reason whatsoever.
But he was no match for Curtis. During the brawl, Curtis landed a solid punch and roughly four heavy kicks to Cemal's head. Cemal died the next day. A subsequent investigation found Curtis guilty of manslaughter. Four additional years were added to his sentence. He was now looking at a release in 2013.
Curtis Warren was not one to stay idle. On February 15, 2005, The Guardian revealed that new charges were being brought against good old Cocky. Using phones and visitations, he had established new lines of communication with some of his associates while in prison. His drug network was still ongoing.
But Curtis had fallen for the same trick twice. Authorities bugged his accomplices' phones. They managed to eke out information to bring charges against Curtis and 10 other men as well. According to the book Cocky, in March 2006, another 3.5 years were added to Curtis's sentence.
At 43 years old, Curtis was still staring down another decade in prison. He needed to find a way to see the outside world again while he was still relatively young.
But then, he won his appeal. He was granted early release. On June 14th, 2007, 2 weeks after his 44th birthday, Curtis Warren was released from prison. As he breathed in the first fresh air in nearly 11 years, Curtis wondered, would this be his chance to start anew?
His homecoming provided little optimism. His father had died while he was in prison, and the rest of his family disavowed his existence. And most of his friends had been arrested or killed during the years he was gone.
On top of all that, the British government, along with most European nations, refused him a passport, and they placed him in the Lifetime Offender Management Program to keep tabs on him. Curtis was now being closely watched by this serious organized crime agency, which is just as serious as it sounds.
But the cocky watchman wasn't going to play it safe. A few weeks after his release, he traveled as far as his restrictions would allow him, the tiny island of Jersey.
Nestled between the UK and France in the English Channel, Jersey is a sort of no man's land between the two nations, significantly less law enforcement, and its economy relied on whatever goods an enterprising importer could bring onto the island. Curtis knew it was the perfect place to restart his drug business.
Of course, the serious organized crime agency was watching his every move. With cutting-edge phone surveillance, they learned he planned to smuggle 180 kilos of cannabis from mainland Europe to Jersey Island.
5 weeks. That's how long Curtis Warren was free before he was arrested again. On October 7th, 2009, Curtis was found guilty of drug smuggling and sentenced to another 13 years in prison. This time, in the UK.
Now the British finally took their crack at uncovering Curtis's riches. In November 2013, he was ordered to pay a whopping 198 million British pounds. He appealed, lost, refused to pay the fine, and was ordered to remain in prison for an additional 10 years.
Curtis Warren began his criminal career as a child. He reached heights no British gangster had ever seen before, overseeing an empire with connections around the globe. But his success made him overconfident. He made mistakes and refused to learn from them. In many ways, his fall was inevitable, but he always remained true to himself. He always stayed cocky. Thanks again for listening to Kingpins.
For more information on Curtis Warren, amongst the many sources we used, we found Cocky, The Rise and Fall of Curtis Warren, Britain's Biggest Drug Baron by Tony Barnes, Richard Elias, and Peter Walsh, extremely helpful to our research.
You can find more episodes of Kingpins and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Kingpins, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Kingpins on Spotify, just open the app and type Kingpins in the search bar.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
Kingpins was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Anthony Valsic, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Carly Madden. This episode of Kingpins was written by Dan Hess, with writing assistance by Kate Gallagher, and stars Kate Leonard and Alastair Murden.
Don't forget to check out the new Spotify original from Parcast, Very Presidential with Ashley Flowers. Every Tuesday through the 2020 election, host Ashley Flowers shines a light on the darker side of the American presidency, exposing wildly true stories about history's most high-profile leaders. There's torrid love affairs, shocking cover-ups, and even murder. To hear more, follow Very Presidential with Ashley Flowers, free on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.